You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
If I haven't met you, my name's Joel. Welcome to New City. Welcome listening on the podcast. If you're listening, I know that we're not live on Zoom tonight. Again, I apologize. But it's good to be here. It's really nice to be here. Full disclosure, Thomas and I had a bit of a wild week. We had a funeral of Thomas's papa out in South Australia, and it was really beautiful. It was a nice time of togetherness and being with family. We left yesterday morning at 8 a.m. and I didn't get home because I had to pick up Hank from the Blue Mountains. I didn't get home till 9 p.m. We were in transit that whole time. So we slept well last night. It was good. It was good. But thank you, as always, for being the space that you are, New City. It's just nice to be able to rock up and know that you don't have everything together. It doesn't all go well, but it's nice to just be here and not feel like you have to perform and just, yeah. So thank you, Musos, for creating that space. Hey, we're in a series on the wisdom literature. Can anyone, without looking at the slides, name the three books of wisdom that we're looking at? Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Well done. This will test your memory. There's a fourth book that sometimes gets snuck into the wisdom literature, but we're not covering. It is Harry Potter. The epitome, but which one? Psalms sometimes get snuck in there. We looked at conflict and how the wisdom literature handles conflict and how we might do it. And then last week we looked at money. This week we're looking at the theme, how not to be a jerk. That's our wisdom literature theme for the evening. Okay, let's do something that you probably haven't been asked to do in church before. I want you to picture somebody who you can think of who is a jerk. Now, maybe we need to come up with a definition of jerk to start off with. Turn to the person next to you. Say like a couple of words that come to mind when you hear the word jerk. It's such an offensive word. Like it's grotesque. I've thought about it so many times this week. What words come to mind? You've got like 12 seconds. Go. Okay, 6 seconds left. Clock's ticking. Okay, here we go. What are our synonyms for the word jerk? Or what words came to mind then? Yeah, yell them out. Narcissism. Interesting. Yep. Okay, others? Arrogant. Selfish. Two at once. Yep. You're really hogging the space there. Yep. Other words? Abusive. Yep. Uncaring. Yep. Okay, I asked you all to have in your mind, you're not going to have to say who they are out loud, don't worry, this is safe, this is your private territory. Have you all got someone in mind who you think, oh yeah, this person is who I would consider a jerk? Maybe it's easy for you to come up with someone, maybe it's actually quite difficult. I'm interested to know. I almost want to do a poll. How many of those are family members? Okay. I didn't ask you to put your hands up, but there were hands. Family members. Oh, it's so hard when family members, we clash, we collide. How many of them were bosses? Any in the room? None of our bosses. Wow, incredible. Oh, okay, we had one. We had one in the room. Any just general work colleagues? Is that a space? Yep, a couple. And then let's just go like frenemies, baby. Like, let's put them in that camp. We've got a few there. Have I missed any major categories? Don't worry, you don't need to yell it out. Sorry? Politicians, there we go. There's some hands there. Look, we could talk. Oh, it's so nice talking about jerks, isn't it? Because it's not us. It's them. We're not the ones. I assume, maybe, did anyone have themselves? You don't have to put your hand up. It's nice to think about other people who are worse than us, because competition, as we saw last week, makes us feel good about ourselves. Hey. But we're going to find that that's not always healthy and not necessarily biblical. I am going to posit a non-controversial theory to start with, which is we need less jerks in the world. Yep, I don't think that's too controversial. I want to tell you about some theories that I have around jerkhood. Then we're going to jump into the concept of humility as an antidote to being a jerk. I want to flesh out humility throughout the wisdom literature, because that's where wisdom literature really shines, this concept of humility. And we're going to land it with Jesus. So that's where we're tracking. Any questions at this point, or thoughts, criticisms? Good. Let's go, shall we? Can I introduce you to a study which I thought was fascinating when it came to looking at real jerks? Okay, they did this study. They gave people a jar of hot sauce, like really spicy stuff, and they gave them a partner. Now, the partner didn't actually exist, but they partnered them up with this person who didn't exist, and they said, this person really hates hot sauce. They can't stand spice. It's your job to determine how much hot sauce this person is going to have to eat. So they gave them a spoon. Now, before they did that, they told them the other person's political viewpoint. And they didn't just say this person is, it was in the States, so it wasn't just Republican-leaning or Democrat-leaning. It was, this person is Democrat and hates Republicans, like really can't stand them. And they gave them a script that the other person had written all about how much they hate the other side, and vice versa. Now, it's probably not surprising to you that the people who got somebody who didn't like them put more hot sauce into the cup. Does that surprise anyone? No? This is, they call it aggressive behavior in psychology. So that's what they were trying to emulate. And in particular, they wanted to look at aggression when they had their worldview threatened. So when your worldview becomes threatened, according to this study, you're more likely to put extra hot sauce into your frenemy, enemy, friend, whoever it is. Their mouth. That's cruel, isn't it? That's like the definition of jerk. Why would you do that? Now, of course, we're talking trends here, but that's not the end of the study. Here's the twist, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. Before they did any of that, they were broken into two different groups. One group was asked to write a paragraph about an exam that was coming up, and explain their thoughts on the exam. How are they feeling about sitting an exam in a few weeks' time? How are you feeling about, you know, that stressful situation? So that was group number one. Group number two were asked, and this is where it gets a bit depressing and morbid, they were asked to imagine how they might die. And they had to sit with that, and they had to think about the feelings that might come up with that point and how they felt about when that could happen. They were asked to sit in that. And then everyone went in and was given the cup of hot sauce. The people who were asked to think about death put more hot sauce in the other person's mouth. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? This is what's called mortality salience. Mortality salience is how real death feels to you at any given point. And mortality salience does all sorts of wild things to us. Here's one of my theories for why we need less jerks in the world. I think we're going to increasingly have more and more jerkism because, here's my theory I'm playing with, we have increased mortality salience in society. Hold with me. COVID, all of us, if you're here today, have lived through a pandemic. We have on tap a steady stream of visuals of violence around the world. We live in a period now of imminent threat of war, potentially world war, and thanks to media and social media, we have it in real time. So there is this increasing mortality salience that I think is floating around at the same time as an inability to speak about death well. And that will do strange things to how we act. Mortality salience has also been shown to foster a sense of greed. Mortality salience has also been linked to spending on luxury goods. And that makes sense. Like, if you know that you're going to die, you're going to go out and live it up. You're going to live your best life. Who cares about everyone else? It's been shown to be connected with antisocial behavior, self-centeredness, indulgence. And overall, they've said it causes people to search for security through materialistic consumption. Not good. Hey, we don't like this idea. We don't like mortality salience is the gist. But here's the twist. Again, this just keeps twisting and turning. That's not all that mortality salience does. Mortality salience has also been shown to prompt people to appreciate life more. In another study, mortality salience has brought about greater concern for others and less materialistic behavior. And yet another study, it has been shown to heighten pro-social behavior. So in some ways, as we think about death, we go one of two ways. We either tear others down or we seek to live for ourselves. Oh, sorry, or we lift others up and we give more of ourselves. Here's a theory I'm playing with. I'm just playing with all these theories this week. It's been good fun. Religion feels like it does the same thing. Have you? Okay, yeah, I see some nods. I have met Christians who are the most profoundly life-giving, healing, generous people that I've met. And I'm sure that you've met similar Christians who are just so overflowing with goodness and love. Like, it's just like, wow, I can see the source of that goodness. And then I've met Christians who are the most soul-sapping, judgmental, hate-filled people. The first is driven by generosity. The second is driven by fundamentalism, in whatever form of fundamentalism you take it, whether it's dogmatic religion or personality, however you frame it. The difference, I think, is humility. It feels like it keeps coming down to this concept that we find in the wisdom literature. I think that feels to be at the crux of it. So can we jump into this concept of humility? I feel like it feels important. Ecclesiastes. Who's grown to love Ecclesiastes? A few folk. We went through it as a series a year and a half, 2 years ago. And it was so rich just sitting in this book where everything is fleeting, or everything is meaningless, or everything is vanity. Everything just like comes and goes and disappears and you can't grasp hold of anything. That's Ecclesiastes to a T. Ecclesiastes and Job present two different types of humility. And we're going to create a bit of an anatomy of humility here. There is intellectual humility and what we'd call existential humility. Intellectual humility and existential humility. Ecclesiastes, what it really emphasizes is the limits of human knowledge, and the inevitability of mortality. So it's sitting in that mortality salience realm. Ecclesiastes chapter 8:17. Then I saw, says the teacher, then I saw all that God has done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun, despite all their efforts to search it out. No one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it, says Ecclesiastes. Surely, in chapter 3, verse 19, surely the fate of human beings is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Humans have no advantage over animals, says Ecclesiastes. I remember when I knew everything. Some other people did too, apparently. It felt good, didn't it? Here's my little humble brag I want to give. When I was 18, I knew everything. That's not the humble brag. I felt like, do you remember that? It felt like you just understood everything that existed. And like you were so confident about your knowledge. For me, this is how it tracked. I did my bachelor's degree and I got to the end of that and I was like, yeah, I feel confident that I've got a good solid grasp on how society works. I then went and did a master's, and by the end of that, I was like, I'm pretty sure I understand how things tick. Like, I feel like I've got it. I made the mistake of doing a PhD, and by the time that finished, those in the room who've done a PhD, you're like, just don't do it, don't do it. By the time that finished, I got to the end, and I specialized in LGBT experiences of religion. I got to the end of it, and I thought, I have no idea. Like, I've got nothing. I thought that as I went through, I would get more and more confident in my ability to give a critique of society, of give a well-reasoned argument for why we needed to head down one path or the other. I got to the end of it and I thought, nope, I'm tapping out. That's my humble brag. I'm so humble. I know nothing. Ecclesiastes, I think, nails it here when the author says, no one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Start scratching. If you think you've got it, you've missed the mark. Like, no one is being fooled except you at this point. There is so much to understand. It is so complex. We can do nothing but have intellectual humility. Otherwise, it's just a bit of a joke. Job tracks a similar kind of humility. Initially, he was a man of great wealth and righteousness, but then he's faced with great suffering in the story of Job. And his initial response is to question God's justice. Why, God, would you do this? I have been a good person all my life. I have been righteous through and through. And I, Job, know how you work. I understand how you, God, function. And as the narrative progresses, Job gradually comes to realization his own insignificance in the grand scheme of things, but even more so, he acknowledges that his understanding of God's ways are limited, so much so that all he can do is submit. Job chapter 42. I've heard of you by hearsay, but now my eyes have seen you, therefore I retract what I said. And I turn around in dust and ashes. I know you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. Surely I spoke of things I didn't understand, things too wonderful for me to know. Therefore, I despise myself. Well, that's hefty words, isn't it? Maybe he takes it a bit too far there. But he gets to the point where he says, I thought I knew you, God. I thought I knew you. But now, having been on this whole journey, I understand. I saw you, God, but all I saw was a glimmer of, a moment in the corner of my eye of something that may have looked perhaps like your majesty. But now I want to see you in full. And so Job concludes as the beginning through to the end. Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will depart. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. Do you see that humility that comes through there? It's this knowledge that our knowledge is so finite. Sociologists would take that and they would call it cultural humility as well. This recognition that, okay, our knowledge that we have here, it's such a small sliver of knowledge that exists in the world. There's more to it. I wonder how you find that. Do you find that demoralizing, that you know nothing? Do you buck up against it? Or is that liberating for you? Again, I think there's two different paths that we take. Some people, they say, oh no, I have to understand everything. I have to grasp it in order to control it. For others, it's I can't control it in the first place. I just need to let go and appreciate that. Again, no judgment either way. It's just two different ways of processing the same reality that you're dirt. But dirt has value. I'm not saying it's nothing. It's just we're small. More and more, we discover just how good it is in terms of well-being and health to feel small. It's so healthy to discover, oh, there is something far bigger than me. That's intellectual and existential humility. Can we add a layer? Let's call this relational humility. This is where Proverbs really shines. Proverbs, as we said at the beginning of the series, it's this image of Lady Wisdom as she weaves chokmah, wisdom, through the universe. She weaves wisdom into creation and shows how society typically functions. It can't be taken as rules, but as proverbs. Here's one for your tip book for next time that you're in a meeting with your boss. Let someone else praise you and not your own mouth. An outsider and not your own lips. How nice does it feel to be praised by someone? So good. You're all amazing. Take the compliment. Do not exalt yourself in the king's presence. And do not claim a place among his great men. It is better for him to say to you, come up here, than for him to humiliate you before his nobles. That's Proverbs 25, 6 and 7. And I love it. It's so sensible. You don't walk into the CEO's office when the whole board is sitting there and say, hey, look what I've done for the company. Because then you will be utterly humiliated. Instead, Proverbs says, allow the CEO to bring you up in front of the company and say, check it out. Look what this person achieved. And all of a sudden you are lifted up. Pride in Proverbs 29:23, pride brings a person low, but the lowly in spirit gain honor. In Proverbs, it is all about recognizing how we relate to one another. It's this relational humility. And it doesn't demand one's status over the other, but it recognizes the importance of coming in and honoring the people around you. Remember last week, I pointed out the Pope had come to Indonesia and people loved the Pope because the Pope was coming across as poor. Can we just call that false humility there? Like there's something there which just doesn't sit right. But everyone loved it. So the Pope was playing his cards right, perhaps. So there's our three types of humility. relational, existential, and intellectual. Relational says, I am other-oriented. Intellectual humility says, I'm open to new insights and I'm going to seek learning. Existential humility says, I'm aware of something larger than myself. We are people who recognize, if we're doing humility right, according to the wisdom literature, we are people who recognize our smallness. We refuse to place ourselves at the center of our universe, and we lift up those around us. I think if we're doing all of those things, we will avoid being jerks. That kind of tracks. Thankfully, as we slide on into the New Testament, this image of humility only expands. And for me, this is where the crux of it lies. Philippians chapter 2. If you've been around churches for a while, you'll know this passage. Philippians 2 from verse 5. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Jesus. Again, we're in that relational space. Have the same mindset as Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing. By taking on the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Talk about mortality salience. Talk about humility. We're called as New City Church, if you call yourself part of this community, if you call yourself in any way a follower of Jesus, we are called to live a life of humility, which for some of us is hard. I'll put my hand up for that. It's hard. We're called to live a life in which we uplift others constantly. It struck me this week, though, that I could sit here and preach it myself, or we could sit here and preach at each other that you need to be more humble. I'm sure that we've had preachers do that in the past. You need to be more humble. And we would try, we would give it a red hot go, but it will be really hard. And I fear that we would be setting ourselves up for failure in a lot of fronts. Here's why. I think, and I could be totally wrong on this, again, like I could, don't quote me, but feel free to quote me, but I could be very wrong. I think in order to be truly humble, it always has to start with an understanding of your own dignity and worth. I think in order to be truly humble, you have to understand just how valuable you are. If you look at Jesus, who being in very nature God, didn't consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. If you look at him, like if you look at Jesus, there is no question that Jesus didn't understand his worth. There is no question that Jesus didn't know that he was fully equal to the Father. Jesus in every way understood that he was the sovereign creator of the universe, by whom, through whom, and for whom all things were made. That was the starting point for Jesus. And Jesus at that point, when he understood all of that, he was able to make himself humble. So often, I get into a pattern of trying to make myself humble by trying to convince myself that I am not worthy. when I feel like I am not worthy, when I feel like I am useless, when I feel like I am not of hope, that is not humility. In fact, it is the epitome of self-absorption at that point, because I am, once again, at the center of my own universe. There is no such thing as narcissism without insecurity. Jesus' humility comes from a place of deep, deep confidence. And I feel as though in this space, we could sit here and call each other out for not being humble enough very easily. We could nitpick. But that's not the culture that we want to develop. Instead, and it might be counterintuitive, I know that this community has been beaten so many times. I know that as we gather together, so many of you have been through the ringer and your confidence has been shot. You need to be humble, sure. But for you, in order to get there, you need to know your own worth. That's step one. You need to know just how loved you are. You need to understand just how deeply passionate God is about you. And then you start building this solid rock of, wow, I am loved in myself. I'm loved by myself. I'm loved by community. I'm strong. I'm secure. I have a foundation. Then we can start that overpouring that takes place, that outpouring that happens. The habits of humility come from a place of certainty. One of the things I love about this community is when I look around, I see us, I see you striving for intellectual humility. I see you wanting to understand more of God without taking cheap answers. I see you looking for existential humility, saying, I don't want to just take the doctrines and dogma that I grew up with. I want to challenge it. I want to fight it. I want to wrestle with it. And so often in this community, I see the weaving of relational humility, that Proverbs humility coming out over and over again. And for that, I want to say a deep thank you. And as we keep growing deeper together as a community, let's not lose that. Let's commit. I want to commit. I want to invite you to commit in some way to being a community in which we constantly seek to lift up the other, knowing our worth, knowing our dignity, not grasping equality for our own advantage, but rather giving ourselves, making ourselves nothing, and being obedient as Jesus did, maybe even obedient to death on a cross, whatever that looks like. Can I pray for us? God, I thank you that even the cross was not too low for you. It is remarkable that we follow a humble God. I can understand a God who is powerful. I can understand a God who is fierce. I can understand a God who knows all. I struggle to understand a God who is humble. And yet that is who you are. And then, God, you invite us to follow in your footsteps. Would you open our eyes to the wonder of your majesty? Would you open our eyes to the glory of your creation, so that as we stand in awe, we discover again and again and again just how small we are. And as we realize just how loved we are, would we be open to discovering how small we are, that we might know true humility in every way. Thank you, Jesus, for paving this path. Would we as New City Church refuse to be jerks, but would we be people of overflowing humility? Amen.